Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A year ago, the New Hampshire legislature and governor took the unusual step of establishing a whole new agency called the Office of the Child Advocate. Lawmakers said it was part of a new, aggressive commitment to reform New Hampshire's child welfare system. It's a system that came under severe criticism several years ago after the deaths of two little girls whose family troubles were known to the Division of Children, Youth, and Families. Now, a year into its existence, the Office of the Child Advocate has released its first annual report, and while it says improvements have been made, Director Moira O'Neill describes how far she thinks the state still has to go, saying, "We wait around for children to be battered and beaten before we help." Today in The Exchange, Moira O'Neill is with us, and let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Director O'Neill, welcome back. It's really nice to see you.
Thanks so much for having me, Laura. I'm willing to come out in the cold to talk about New Hampshire's children anytime.
Well, before we jump into the specifics of this report, and there's a lot here, just sort of lay the table for us, if you could, Director O'Neill. Tell us what we know now about adverse childhood experiences, how they can literally remap our brains, our emotional systems. I mean, that's what this work is really all about.
It is, and thanks for asking that question. I think it's a great place to start. You know, in just the past couple of years, we've had this explosion of science around brain development, and we know so much more about what happens to children when they're in what's now called adverse childhood experiences. This is just extreme stress that you might experience when you're in a highly neglectful or abusive situation. So if you think about a good analogy is you're trying to cross the street and a truck is coming at you. You get really nervous, your heart is racing, you're really scared, and there's sort of toxic stress hormones flowing through your body to make you alert and ready to run. Children who are living in abusive situations feel like that all the time. And the stress of those negative situations actually start to change the architecture of the brain. So that you have this developing brain. It takes, now we know, about 24 years for a brain to fully develop. And all of those things that have to connect and work together inside that brain start to cease in their development, and eventually children change entirely the trajectory of their health for the whole continuum of their lives. So we're seeing mental health problems, we're seeing long-term heart disease, diabetes,
wow,
depression, people don't do well in school, they may not get jobs, so it really has long-term effects. We need to act now to prevent abuse and neglect so that doesn't happen to children.
So that's the fundamental basis of all the work that you were trying to do.
Absolutely. That's what guides us in everything that we do.
I'd like to ask you about that quote, Director O'Neill, that I mentioned in my introduction. "We wait around for children to be battered and beaten before we help." Pretty strong language there. When you say "we," as in "we wait around," who do you mean "we"?
I think we as a state and as a community, but the way that the infrastructure of the state is set up is to respond to abuse and neglect. And, you know, this goes back about 100 years when we used to, we had nothing. There was no help for anyone. There's a very well-known story about little Mary Ellen, who was a girl in New York City who was really beaten badly by her caregiver. And the folks who eventually responded for her actually used the Humane Society for Animals.
Oh, my goodness.
In order to take her into court and get her safety. And so after that, we started to see the development of these child welfare agencies over time. And so that was a response. It was a reactive response to concerns about children being abused. But now what we know so well about child development really needs to start leading us into more proactive upstream responses to children so that we can avoid abuse and neglect altogether, knowing that once a child is abused and neglected, there's damage that happens to their development that sometimes is not retrievable.
So we here in New Hampshire, this we who waits around, as you say, is it DCYF? Is it the courts? Is it, you know, somebody's neighbor? Is it a teacher? Is it a doctor? I mean, who is we specifically?
So it starts with all of us in New Hampshire. It's fairly unique. Every single one of us is a mandated reporter.
Wow, you and me sitting here.
Absolutely. All of us, anyone. So that what that means is, first of all, we've agreed as a community here in New Hampshire that we're all responsible for children. And by law, if we suspect that a child is being abused or neglected, we need to report that to DCYF. So the next level of the infrastructure is that DCYF is the lead agency in responding to abuse and neglect. So they're the folks that we need to bring this information to. Now, a lot of people may not know that they're a mandated reporter. They also may not feel comfortable getting involved in, you know, making reports about children. There's a wonderful organization right now called the Know and Tell. It's the Granite State Children's Alliance is the organization, and the initiative is Know and Tell. And they're going around the state teaching everyone what their responsibilities are, how to recognize the signs and symptoms of abuse or neglect, and how to tell about it. And people can get information about that at knowandtell.org.
Just give us, for instance, Director O'Neill. So let's say I suspect something's going on down at the house down the street, but I don't want to be a snoop. I don't want to, you know, make something up. Maybe I'm not sure if it's going on, but I have a sneaky suspicion. I see a child at the bus stop, you know, who just doesn't look right day after day after day. What do I specifically do? What's the best pathway for me?
So that's a great question. To clarify, the law says you must report suspected abuse or neglect. So we're not all experts. We can learn from things like the Know and Tell initiative, but we're still not expected to be experts on this. If we just feel like it's not right, we call DCYF. Because DCYF has folks who are experts on the phone. They don't mind if you call with something that doesn't rise to the level. In fact, they screen out a lot of calls because they're not abuse and neglect. But they do appreciate people calling and sharing their concerns.
So that's the pathway.
Absolutely.
Calling DCYF. Yes. And in a few minutes, we'll clarify that, you know, you've been investigating some of the problems that happens when people call DCYF, that reports just seem to stay there. But just staying on this for a moment, because, again, as an average person, it does feel like a weighty responsibility to hear that I am a mandated reporter. You said that's kind of unique here in New Hampshire?
Yeah, there are some states that have it. Generally, in states, the law requires certain types of people to be mandated reporters, people who would be in the know, so healthcare professionals, teachers, coaches, people who are sort of educated to understand that. And there's a lot in their training that's required. But I think that New Hampshire is probably taking the lead and early on and saying, like, we all need to be responsible for children. We all need to recognize when children are in trouble.
What sort of anxieties do people have? Hearing that they are mandated reporters, having a suspicion, not being sure, what's the sort of worry that your average person like me might have?
Well, I guess it would be great to hear from callers who might explain that. But, you know, I could only speak to the sense that DCYF has had, in most states, actually, a pretty bad reputation for taking people's children. So DCYF is responsible for responding to abuse and neglect and getting children out of harm's way. So that does often translate to a child being removed from a family, although that's not the focus of the agency. That's what we hear about. And parental rights are so important. Families are sacrosanct. So when the state intervenes and takes a child, that's very uncomfortable for folks. So no one wants to be that person who makes someone lose their child. A lot of people don't want to get involved. And some people are just worried that they may be making a mistake. So it's important that we encourage people to have the confidence to just say, I think there may be something going on here. And hopefully what DCYF will be doing with its latest transformation of the agency is helping more of the community understand that it's a helping agency and not a policing agency.
Is that the impression that people have? It's a policing agency. It's going to come in and say, you're a bad parent and I'm taking your daughter and son right now.
I think so. I think that's what people fear the most. And there have been stories, and of course, even the creation of our office came out of the deaths of children, which a lot of the sense of that, not necessarily the what actually happened, but the sense was that DCYF didn't protect those children. So
it had information,
yes,
knowledge, and
right.
It didn't act quickly
enough.
So
there's a problem of trust there, and that's what the agency is working really hard to reform. And we have to trust that there are people who go to work every day at DCYF who really want to protect children. And for the most part, the focus is on keeping families together. It's very difficult to actually remove a child from a family. But now we have more and more resources. Last year, we got money for voluntary services so that caseworkers are now equipped to go in and actually help families. Sometimes it's something as simple as paying the mortgage. When families are under stress, maybe there's mental illness. We're seeing a lot more drug addiction happening that's affecting the ability to parent. But if a caseworker can help a family get it together, the child may not be abused. They can't help if they don't know that the child's at risk.
Again, the number for you to join us today is 1-800-892-6477. We're sitting down with Moira O'Neill this morning, Director of the Office of Child Advocate. In her first annual report, she gives her assessment of how New Hampshire's been doing in protecting vulnerable children. There's a tone in the report that says far more change is needed, both in terms of funding and a broader cultural shift that puts child safety first. We'd love to hear from you this morning. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Director O'Neill, Lorelei sent us an email from Concord. She says, I want to ask Director O'Neill, what has been the most difficult part of establishing this type of office in New Hampshire? Lorelei, great question. Go ahead, Director O'Neill, please.
Well, that is a great question. And like everything at the Office of the Child Advocate, it's hard to answer because we are such a unique agency. But let me start by, thanks for that question, Lorelei, and just step back a little bit and say, I arrived here almost a year ago today, basically, January 30th, and people immediately started turning to me to get answers to what was going on. We never really had the conversation about what is the Office of the Child Advocate. So the Office of the Child Advocate is an independent agency that was established to oversee DCYF and promote the best interests of children. So probably one of the most difficult things has been making sure that it was understood throughout government that that the office is independent, because that is very unique. There are no independent agencies in the state, and so it's hard to sort of take apart, our ability to be able to do what we need to do, access information without encountering obstacles to that, although DCYF has been very good at helping us get that started. Getting the word out about the office has actually been fairly easy because people knew about us even before we got here. Getting set up in terms of the infrastructure of us to be able to respond to people has been difficult because it's taken time. It took us months to find an office. We have a very generous support from the Department of Information Technologies, who have set us up with a fabulous case management system, but it took months for that to get started and then many months for designing it and then entering the data. So that was slow. And as we're developing that stuff, going through all the negotiations to access information also took time. Throughout all of that building period, people were calling from the first day.
Really?
And so trying to
manage.
What
were they calling about?
People call about, foster parents call about worries about children, people who want to adopt children who aren't able to get that. Our number one call is caseworkers who aren't returning their calls. Children who are out of state and no one checking on them. We've got, problems with children who are institutionalized and not necessarily getting their needs met. So there's a whole variety of things, or just parents who are upset that DCYF is involved with them at all.
Are you kind of like an ombudsman, Director O'Neill?
We are an ombudsman.
For people who are dissatisfied with the system.
Yes, we are. That is what we are. The statute reflects what a typical statute would reflect for designing an ombudsman office. We're called the Office of the Child Advocate because there already is an ombudsman in DHS. There is an ombudsman office that takes complaints about DCYF. And that's part of the infrastructure that we try to promote. When people have difficulties with a DCYF case, they should call the caseworker, they should call the supervisor if that's not satisfactory, and they should call the ombudsman's office. And we don't think that they're used enough, but they are there to help people. And then when things aren't really going well, it would come to us at a slightly higher level, slightly policy level. So to answer Lorelei's question, getting set up and being able to respond to people at the same time has been difficult. We have our own backlog of being able to respond to people, and it's somewhat overwhelming. We are three. I have two full-time staff, and it's a really broad and intense level of work for us.
Let's go to our listeners, Director O'Neill, and then so many more questions for you. Again, the number for you to join us if you'd like, 1-800-892-6477. Email is great, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter. It's NHPR Exchange. Again, our email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Director O'Neill, Pedro's calling in from Concord. Hi, Pedro. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
So I wanted to ask Director O'Neill, what else is being done to assist DCYF just in the form of community-based practices or anything that's being done to really support the families outside of depending on DCYF?
That's a great question, Pedro, and thank you for bringing that up, because it underscores a lot of the work that's happening at DCYF, or actually beyond DCYF in DHHS, which is really putting together what we're calling a system of care. And this is really an upstream approach to build a whole infrastructure of support for families before they're at risk for abuse and neglect, so before they ever come to DCYF. I happened to go with a group of legislators last summer, and also one of the judges from the district court, to New Jersey, where we were able to meet with folks who have established a wonderful system of care there, where anytime a child is in any level of family-defined crisis, within 1 hour, somebody will be at their house to help them sort through and figure out, do they need services, do they need support, do they need learning? And that's not just the child, but the family as well. So it's taking that really preventative approach. You know,
it's like preventative medicine in a way for family stress or dysfunction.
Especially critical, knowing what we know now about the damage to a child's brain and development as soon as they are even at risk of being abused and when they are abused. So preventing that altogether and really supporting families to understand child development, to understand coping when children aren't doing well, and being able to manage these crises moments so that they can all be healthy and stay together. We expect that there'll be considerable drops in foster care and certainly institutional placements.
What's your relationship? Again, getting back to Lorelei's excellent question, because your office is new. People are still trying to figure it out. What's your relationship with DCYF? You know, having done all the reading and followed this issue for a while, it seems like, Director O'Neill, you're kind of a critic, but also a supporter.
Yeah, we are. We could be the thorn in your side, but basically, we're critiquing how the agency is developing to be best serving for children. So there are a couple of DCYFs. There's the DCYF that is under a transformation right now. There are high-level conversations that are engaging with community, that are talking about what is best for children, that are talking about brain science, that are talking about getting upstream and doing better. And then there are the people every day who are walking into doors with unknown beyond them, where that kind of talk hasn't quite disseminated. So there's people who are doing the work that's now, and there are people that are talking about the future. We support the future, and we're trying to get that to translate into the work that's happening every day.
All right. Well, coming up, we'll look more at the recommendations of the report, including hiring a lot more social workers for DCYF and making sure a culture of child safety is paramount. We'll find out what that means, and we'll keep hearing from you. So your questions and comments are welcome. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, more on how the state is doing when it comes to protecting our most vulnerable children. What are your questions for the state's child advocate, Moira O'Neill? Send us an email, exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Director O'Neill, lots of people who want to talk to you, so let's go right back to our listeners. George is in Portsmouth. Hi, George. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure.
My question for Moira was regarding her stance on how DCYS can operate on preponderances of evidences when drawing conclusions in cases regarding child safety, as opposed to following statute and actual like court law. I have a couple friends, so my experience in this is rather limited. I don't have children, but a friend of mine is experiencing a great deal of issues, you know, even now in the court systems, because DCYS can have findings based on preponderances of evidence. A great deal of his frustrations is kind of stemming from that, you know, today.
So he feels sort of wrongly targeted, George, and is struggling through the court systems because of that?
Oh, yeah, exactly. So in his case, you know, it's kind of like one of his children is autistic. And so there's a lot of issues, you know, stemming from mental health, which I heard you mention before.
Sure.
Too, you know, regarding getting the child placed in the proper schooling, you know, to care for her properly, you know what I mean? So yeah, he's kind of, you know, kind of having a lot of issues, but originally the DCYS case was based on a preponderance of evidence. I've actually seen the, you know, the paperwork that he showed me the paperwork, and a lot of the issues that are going on now in the legal system are because that preponderance of evidence stands up. It overrides the state, the laws, you know.
Wow, George, and you sound like a caring friend. It's nice to hear from you. And, you know, we've talked a bit about DCYF, but the courts are a big part of this, Director O'Neill.
They are. And thank you, George, for the question. It sounds like you're a good and supportive friend. You know, There are no cut and dried cases. There are always complications, and you mentioned that one of the children of your friend has autism, and so making sure that kids get all of the care and, you know, specific educational services is sometimes complicated by the fact that they don't exist or they're hard to get, and so that's complicated for families. It's also complicated for DCYF. Our concern about the law that protects children is that this is Chapter 169(c)(2), which says the purpose of this chapter, the purpose of the law, is to provide protection to children whose life, health, or welfare is endangered. The second question, or the second sentence, says its further purpose of the chapter is to establish a framework to protect the rights of all parties, and that includes parents. So we have seen a number of times where children really needed to be addressed, their needs needed to be addressed in a certain way that they weren't because of the inability to bring about the preponderance of evidence, specifically around emotional or psychological maltreatment, because there's such a vague definition of what that is. It's very rare that people bring it forward. I do understand that parents feel as though it's unfair for them, because it's unfair that anybody comes in the first place and says you're not being a good parent. And sometimes DCYF may not do as good a job as they need to, but often it's more complicated than that. And it just seems as though parents are being treated unfairly at times. So what I would suggest is it's really important that parents try to be open to DCYF as a helping agency, follow all of their advice, because they do often set up a system that parents can improve their parenting, understand their children more, take the supports that are available, problem solve with DCYF, and reunification is always the focus. Oftentimes we get so upset with an agency interfering that we don't cooperate with them, and that makes us look worse. If you find that you have a caseworker who's not helpful, or if things seem to be going in the wrong direction, then certainly make sure you reach out to the supervisor, share information with the DHHS ombudsman, make sure they know that you're concerned about that. parents do have legal representation, be sure that your lawyer is best representing you. And then the CASA, New Hampshire, these are court-appointed special advocates who represent the child's interests. Those are people who to really work with and make sure they have lots of information and access to the child so that they can get a good sense of what is in the best interest of the child. Is there an advocate in the court for the children, too?
Well, thank you for the call, George, and good luck to your friend. Again, you can join us at 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. We got an email, Director O'Neill, last week on our program with state lawmakers, and your report came up and funding for DCYF and so forth came up. We got an email from someone who just identified as a family in the North Country. This person says, our family was involved with an assessment by DCYF last year, came away feeling discouraged and demoralized. Mm-hmm. After the initial contact with the department and a follow-up meeting, we heard nothing from the case manager for almost 6 months, despite daily phone calls, regular emails, even handwritten letters and personal visits to the office. These attempts at communication were simply asking for updates on the progress of the assessment. We finally received confirmation that the assessment had been unfounded and later learned that the finding had been reached 4 months before we were informed of it. We are sympathetic to the caseloads and pressures these workers are under, but our family felt totally helpless and frankly tormented by DCYF's lack of response. So this person says, please ask your guest what families of humble financial means can do to ensure the timeliness and integrity of DCYF officials if they have the misfortune to become involved with them. And I want to thank that person for the email. And you've talked a lot about this, Director O'Neill, unreturned phone calls. It sounds simple, but it's huge for families like this.
It does. It does seem really, really simple. And in any government agency, in any agency, customer service is so important. But in DCYF circumstances, responding to people, returning calls, returning emails is actually what builds trust between the agency and the family. And that's really important when you're trying to engage families, you're trying to engage children and understand them and their needs so that you can best meet those needs and determine what it is that, you know, whether abuse or neglect has happened. You've got to be able to talk with people. And that's just trust is so important in that whole process. And so, yeah, that is a number one complaint that we get is that calls are not returned. There may be some caseworkers who are just not good at being responsive. There may be some caseworkers who are new and not experienced, maybe overwhelmed, and they're not getting to their phones. But in general, I really believe that this is a problem of caseloads.
Yeah, and you've talked about that in your report. You said yes. That the investments that the legislature made last time, last session, brought the caseloads down from like 90 per social worker, which sounds unbelievable. I mean, it almost sounds like a typo, to about 40, which still sounds like a lot because you're not just talking about 40 people. You're talking about 40 families. Families may have multiple children and multiple caregivers involved and so forth.
Right. That caseload is still really high. You know, I've talked to caseworkers about it and used the analogy of holding a bright green tennis ball for every child that's on their caseload. You know, because each family will have a couple of children in it. And so, you know, you can't, if you tried to hold a group, a pile of tennis balls for 40 families, you couldn't do it. It would be all over the place. And that's a great analogy of how it feels to be a caseworker who's just got these families all over. And not only is it a lot of people, but each one of those children has a medical record. Each one of those children has a school record. They all have different people that are working with them. Some in a family may have a child who's placed in a residential facility across the state. You still need to see that child all the way across the state. They may have different parents. You know, they may have different mothers, different fathers. It's really a hodgepodge of managing. And so you've got to try to manage all of that and continue with communications and document everything. You know, one of our problems in trying to understand how cases are progressing is that caseworkers aren't able to document what's going on in a case. So it may be very simple and resolved, but no one can see that. There's a very high turnover rate. It's actually dropped a little bit in the past year, and so we're encouraged by that. I think that may be the result of people getting a little confidence that we're looking at helping DCYF, so these caseworkers are getting some support.
How much does a caseworker make? Because it sounds like a very stressful job.
Listen, that person has all of this work to do. They have all of the paperwork to do. They're responsible for the lives of children. They knock on doors. They have no idea what's happening on the other side of that door. They walk into danger every day. They start out at about $38,000 a year. They drive their own cars all around the state. They have an enormous responsibility. That they take those jobs is a measure of their commitment to children. But it's also a measure of our responsibility to make sure that they're well supported. For that amount of money, we need to at least give them reasonable caseloads.
Well, and we'll talk a little bit later about your request for the legislature in this report. How many more caseworkers you think are needed to make sure that other families don't fall into the situation like this family in the North Country that, you know, had to wait 6 months to find out about their own assessment. But back to our listeners, Director O'Neill, and Janet's calling in from Loudoun. Hi, Janet. You're on the air. Thank you for being with us.
Hi. I just wanted to say, bring up the importance of extended family members in cases like this. Several years ago, my 7-year-old grandson, I felt that things were going on at home with his mother's boyfriend. I just had a feeling that things weren't right, and he was spending some time with me, and I questioned him, and he did open up to me about some beginnings of abuse that was going on, which would have escalated if nothing had been said. I called his father, who was my son, who was not did not have custody at the time, and we called the police, and the police came and interviewed my grandson. A restraining order was given against the boyfriend. The mother sided with her boyfriend, effectively abandoning her child, called him a liar, and my grandson went to live with his father.
What's your question for Director O'Neill, Janet?
While this wasn't life-threatening physical abuse, if nobody had said anything, it probably would have gotten to that point.
Yeah,
so
thank you, Janet.
Got him out of there very quickly. DCYF did not have to be involved because the mother just said that her son was a liar and she sided with a boyfriend, didn't want to have anything to do with her son anymore.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks
wow,
for calling.
What a story.
In. Yeah, you underscore two really important things. Right now, we have over 6,000, possibly getting close to 7,000 family members who are taking care of children, largely grandparents. You know, that speaks to the shortage of foster parents, but also the shift in recent years to recognizing how important it is to keep kids with their families. And so we do, I believe the agency does make an effort to find family members for children to stay with when it's not working out in their biological parents. The other thing that you mentioned there that I think is really important for people to think about is it's not uncommon for parents not to believe the allegations that come forth from a child. Sometimes it's just impossible to believe that somebody that they care about would harm their child. And that's not anything I can explain. Have a conversation with folks from domestic violence who would be able to better explain how that happens. But it does. What I can tell you is really important is that no matter what a child says, perception is reality, and we have to support that. It is a form of maltreatment not to believe a child when they believe that they're in harm's way. So listening to them and helping them work through it, even if we don't believe them, is really important. And I believe that's one of the criteria that DCYF may use in determining whether or not a child should stay with a parent or not. It's clear that that parent's not willing to protect them if they won't believe the allegations about abuse.
I understand that more grandparents in the state are stepping in because of all the attention that the tragedies have raised, especially the two little girls who several years ago died, even though DCYF, you know, they were sort of under DCYF's watch. So it seems like more grandparents, like our caller, have stepped up.
They are, and we really do appreciate that. I can't imagine what it's like to be sort of at a point in your life where you think you're done and you're ready to sort of relax and read a book, and suddenly you've got toddlers in the house. But grandparents are really stepping up, and they're organized. Thankfully, if you are a grandparent who's taking care of a child, you should know that there are groups that are organized to support each other. There have been some difficulties because children who go into family care don't necessarily get all of the benefits that a professional foster family might get, things like benefits for child care and other supports. It's really important
that health care and so forth. So if a child goes to a grandparent, can't that grandparent be sort of certified as a foster parent as well?
They can, and they should.
To get those benefits?
They don't have to be, but we encourage them to do so so that they can benefit from that. And remember, you know, any child who loses a family, any child who moves away from parents, that is an adverse childhood experience. So that child, even if they seem like they're well developed, may definitely have some problems occur a little bit later, and you want to be able to access the services you need to make sure that child is well supported.
All right. Well, Janet, thank you so much for the call, and good luck to you and your grandson. And let's take another call, Director O'Neill. This is Kaylee in Ossipee. Kaylee, thank you for being with us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Morning.
I just wanted to call in. I was listening to your station, and I just wanted to extend my gratitude for the services that DCYF is providing. I understand that they have a extremely stressful job, and I hope that with the influx of funding that it enables them to take on just the 12 cases in their caseload as proposed by Governor Sununu. And I just wanted to offer a different perspective on the matter. Currently, I'm in dealings with the DCYF, and it has been a challenge for me.
What kind of dealings, Kaylee, if you don't mind telling us?
Well, I've actually had my child go into the foster care system. He's being cared by a family provider, his aunt, and it's been a really big challenge for me emotionally. I had his dad had some substance abuse issues, and because of that, with my grieving process, I actually developed a substance abuse issue, and so I was struggling with that. And my son was removed from the care of my parents. And basically, they, I believe, had such a large caseload that they kind of removed him and asked questions later, which is kind of challenging right now because my grandparents raised me.
Oh,
that have been married for 57 years, haven't seen him in about 7 months. And they've made some allegations against my father that are all unfounded and slanderously spread them throughout the family, just causing further rift between this blended family.
Well, Kaylee, I am going to let you hold on, okay, because this relates to lots of stories I'm sure you've heard, Director O'Neill, but also the issue that you have raised and that Kaylee raises, that DCYF doesn't have enough people to manage the intricacies of cases like the ones that Kaylee raises. So, Kaylee, just hang on the line, and we'll talk after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange.
Civics 101 has done hundreds of shows about how the government works.
But we realized that we missed a step. Something bigger.
All right, step right up, gentlemen. Don't miss your chance to commit treason.
Our nation, our government, is all built on paper and ink.
That's why we made a 6-part series on the founding documents, the pieces of paper that make us us, or rather, we. Subscribe or listen online at civics101podcast.org. Civics 101 is a production of NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, paying for college. Send us your questions when it comes to student loans, grants, scholarships, and more. You can email us before the show at exchange@nhpr.org. And join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. This hour, we're looking at the findings of a new report by the new office of the Child Advocate here in New Hampshire. And we've been hearing a lot from you. Send us your comments and questions by email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange, or you can give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Director O'Neill, just before the break, we heard from Kaylee, who has a complicated story. She's appreciating that DCYF caseworkers have so many cases to manage. And her case, as she described it, she lost custody of her child, is very complicated. It kind of speaks to what you said earlier.
It is. And Kaylee, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate that you are able to bring this perspective to the conversation. And congratulations on your progress. It sounds like you're, you know, getting things together and are working towards some good health. And I know how hard that is, and I appreciate all that you're doing. And understanding what it means when you're not able to parent the way you really want to. But you've really highlighted how important it is to sometimes let DCYF give you that rest and space that you need in order to take care of yourself so that you can be a better parent. I think that's what it's all about. And I hope that in the future, we will see DCYF as that. Lately, the commissioner from HHS, Commissioner Myers, has been talking about DCYF as being an emergency response agency. That's not what it is right now because it's responsible for so many children in the long term. But it's a great goal to have looking in the future to say that when families are in crisis, we'll respond. But in general, we're going to support them in other ways before we get there. And Laura, I just want to point out that Kaylee's call is really sort of a great example of what we get every day in our office, not just about the topic, but about the length and complexity of the call. We spend a lot of time on the phone with people, some of whom just haven't been listened to in a long time. It's very time-consuming, and it's often heartbreaking. So trying to weed through that and figure out what is this, what's going on here that is a systemic problem from DCYF that we can help to fix. So we do encourage people when they call our office to try to give us just the most succinct initial story that they can so that we can get to work right away and figuring out what needs to happen.
So we talked earlier about, you know, the role of your office, kind of an ombudsman for families, kind of both a critic and a supporter of DCYF. I'm also imagining your office, Director O'Neill, as like a traffic cop in a way. Okay, you maybe should go here, you maybe should go here.
It is. We try to make the system work as it is. So try to get people talking with their caseworkers. And if you have a caseworker who's not calling you back and you're trying the supervisor, they're also overwhelmed. And so they're not always calling people back. The ombudsman I mentioned should be used and should be helpful. And sometimes we can just make a call and say, this person's trying to reach you. Can you please call them back? And oftentimes they do. But then it's sort of, we have information coming through from all levels. We have people calling us with concerns. Sometimes we're out in the field and we discover children who need our attention. And we also get reports every day about what we call incidents. So children who are missing, children who have been injured, children who are in facilities and they've been restrained or secluded. And those are all cases that we need to investigate to make sure that children are being safely cared for.
One of the recommendations in your report, Director O'Neill, is hiring a lot more workers, roughly 100 more social workers, roughly 14 or 15 more nurses. This came up in our roundtable with top lawmakers last week. And by the way, if you didn't listen to the show, Director O'Neill, everybody on the panel, Republicans and Democrats, were very supportive of the work that you do. But we did hear some skepticism from our Republican lawmakers about whether hiring 100 more social workers is the right way to go. Let's hear a little bit from Representative Dick Hinch. Here he says the legislature needs to take a close look at how DCYF is operating before committing to even more funding. Let's hear.
Putting the advocate in was essential, but at the same time, we have to drill down and understand what are those day-to-day duties that the employees have. What can we get rid of? What can we reprioritize so that you know, we're working effectively, because throwing money and saying, okay, well, great, I'm gonna put 100 more employees in there, but what are they gonna do, and what duties? And by the way, there are a number of positions that have not yet been filled.
Okay, so there's Representative Dick Hinch talking. Sometimes the best stuff comes at the tail end of the show. That's why you heard the theme music there. But 100 more caseworkers is a pretty big ask, Director O'Neill. And both Representative Hinch and Senator Morse were, you know, a little skeptical that that much was needed.
Sure. And I actually appreciate those questions and concerns, because I'm well aware that, you know, New Hampshire has limited resources. People are worried about the budget. It's always a concern when you're throwing money. And to be honest, I did this work for 11 years in Connecticut. At the time, that state was very wealthy, and they threw money at problems all the time, and sometimes it exacerbated. It didn't make them better.
Really?
So money is not always the answer. And I understand thinking like we want to drill down and find out what exactly we need, and that had been proposed last year, but then it was dropped. The bottom line is that New Hampshire is not the only child welfare agency in the country. There are many child welfare agencies all around the country. In some states, there are more than one because they're county agencies. But there's a lot of science on what works, and we know it doesn't work. And by the way, New Hampshire actually had a really healthy child welfare system a little over 10 years ago. So it's not recreating the wheel. It's relying on what we know already in terms of
what
our experience has been, and also, you know, what the science tells us about what's manageable and what needs to be done. So the standard that's promoted is somewhere between 12 and 15, depending upon who you're looking at. Yes. And the work of a caseworker is the same in all states. It may be different because of the geographical region we're in. I know that the caseworkers up in the North Country do a hell of a lot more driving than caseworkers do down in Manchester. But other than that, what families need, how you do an assessment, the paperwork, that's pretty much similar. We did get 33 positions for DCYF last session. There's some question about whether or not they're filled, because there are always job vacancies at DCYF. We did look at the workforce data from DCYF. The 33 positions were filled, but there is still a high turnover rate.
I see.
And there are also a lot of people who moved to other positions in the agency. So they still work for the agency, but they're in another position, which opened up their position. So yes, there are positions open. There's still a need. The numbers, actually, what their prioritized needs are, 114 positions, not all caseworkers. So there is a bill that's before the Senate Finance Committee today, actually this afternoon, for 77 positions, which would be 57 caseworkers and 20 supervisors. So 57 caseworkers would bring that caseload down to something that's more manageable. The supervisors are also very important positions, because right now I believe a supervisor is carrying a load of about 8 or 9 caseworkers. And that means 8 or 9 caseworkers times about 40 children. That's like 350 to 400 children that they have to be familiar with and guide these caseworkers. And remember, with the turnover rate, many of our caseworkers are inexperienced, they're new, some of them are very young and haven't had these sort of life exposures, so they need a lot of guidance and mentoring to be able to get the job done and to help calls be returned. So those positions, we do feel strongly that they need to be made available and filled. And I know that there probably are folks who think the Office of the Child Advocate shouldn't be involved in making budget recommendations. But we've done an assessment of the needs of children in the state. It's up to the legislature and the governor to determine how we can best balance the budget and meet those needs.
So that bill for 57, I think you said, caseworkers,
yes.
And how many supervisors?
20 supervisors.
That's before the Senate Finance Committee
today.
Okay.
Senate Bill 6.
All right. Going back to our listeners, and this is a sensitive topic, obviously, child abuse and neglect. So this person who's calling in next chooses to remain anonymous,
sure.
And we'll respect that.
Understood.
In this instance. So go ahead. Thank you for calling in.
Hi there. I am remaining anonymous because I'm actually a current employee of DCYF in New Hampshire. And first of all, I'd like to extend my thanks to Ms. O'Neill for her work. I know that I've spoken to her regarding several of my cases, and she's always been extremely helpful and extremely understanding. And I just think the OCA is a great resource for DCYF right now.
So just wanting to express your appreciation that this office is here to support you.
Yeah. I also wanted to address the issue of our current community resources. I was wondering if the OCA had any suggestions about what we were going to do about our service providers. For example, one of our transportation providers is not required to provide car seats. So, nor are their workers trained in using car seats.
Oh, my goodness. Sure.
Yeah. So we've had several incidents where they've arrived at foster homes and children who should have been rear-facing in seats were facing forward. The foster parent said, hey, can you turn that child around to the car seat, please? And the transportation provider reached in and flipped the car seat right around because the car seat was not snapped into the car.
Yikes.
Yeah, that's not how it's supposed to work. Yeah. Thank you so much for the call. And it's, you know, it's one detail, but it's emblematic of a broader problem.
It is. And thank you so much for your call and for your kind words. I will say that brings us back to what the Office of the Child Advocate is. And, you know, sort of historically, people expect these kinds of agencies to be watchdog agencies and to come out really with teeth bared at the child welfare agency. And that's not what we're all about at all. We don't prosecute people. We don't look for blame in people. We're trying to figure out how do you improve the system. And part of that may be making it better for people to work in the system. So I think that may have surprised a few people in terms of our approach. We're doing a lot of work based in safety science that just looks at where opportunities to learn and decrease the amount of human error that happens. Because every decision that's made is the right decision because it's the decision that was made in that time with the resources available. So that's our approach. And I think that's probably why we're hearing from more and more employees of DCYF, because they're seeing us as an outlet to be able to address issues that they can't within their own system. So,
now, what does that say to you, though, that you're hearing from DCYF employees like this one who just called in, who's coming to you instead of going to her own supervisor or her own ombudsman?
Right. And that's not uncommon. I mean, people worry about their jobs, number one. The Office of the Child Advocate is required by law to maintain confidentiality of anyone who calls us. So there's sort of a whistleblower effect there. I think some people have spoken with their supervisors. Sometimes supervisors call us. I mean, we get calls from every level. We hear even from administrators about problems that are happening. And that's sort of normal in an agency that has been not doing well organizationally and is in a period of transformation. There's issues of trust there, and there's also issues of just not wanting to fix something but not wanting to be the person who takes the lead. We're happy to do that for people. And our expectation is that over time, DCYF will be more open and people will feel more comfortable to bring issues of improvement forward.
Well, thank you again for that call. And here's an email from Melissa who says, there has been so much attention paid to the opioid crisis and those struggling. But Melissa says, my concern is with all the unspoken effects. For example, in our elementary school, there are 100 students and nearly 20% are being raised by their grandparents, and nearly as many are listed under the federal definition of homelessness. Well, Melissa, she says, rather than waiting for the state to do something or blaming the state when something goes wrong, Melissa says, what can we do to help our communities recover? Monitoring and properly funding the state agencies that protect children is a vitally important component, but how can the people of New Hampshire supplement this effort? Melissa, it's a great question, and I'm guessing there's a broad answer to it. Go ahead, Director O'Neill.
Yeah, it is a really good question. First of all, it's really important to underscore that children are often involved when we're talking about substance use disorders. And the opioid epidemic is a terrible and broad thing, but don't forget that there's also a large percentage of the cases that come to DCYF involve alcohol abuse as well. So, and that has always been a problem here in New Hampshire. So any substance use is a problem for raising children. That's an adverse childhood experience. I think what we can do about it, it goes back to, you know, the Know and Tell initiative, which I think is just raising the level of awareness of children in your community. You know, feel confident to to reach out to children, know the children who are in your neighborhood, if you work at school or anywhere. What we've found is the most critical and successful factor for resilience in children is having a single, caring, consistent adult in their life. Knowing a child's name is an enormous impact on children, that they think that someone notices them and cares about them. And when you have those relationships, they will learn to trust you. They will bring problems to you. There are other opportunities, like if you want to really help, volunteering. There's loads
Boys
of
and Girls Clubs, Big Brothers, Big Sisters.
Being that person. And another enormous
YMCA.
Need. Right. One of the things we talked about in our report is representation of children in court, because we don't have lawyers for children when they go to court. We have largely a good majority of children are represented by CASA, New Hampshire volunteers, or CASA GALs, guardian ad litems. Those folks are all volunteers. There aren't enough of them, so some children are represented by paid guardian ad litems. The CASA New Hampshire volunteer movement actually provides an enormous amount of training. They have high standards for people visiting with their clients. So you could be representing a child in court, making sure that their best interest is met. You can get to know children and make sure that all their needs are met. That's a wonderful opportunity. And in what we pointed out in our report was that the guardian ad litems, who are not CASA volunteers, are only required to meet with a child face-to-face once in the life of a case. And that's just not enough to understand
that's not
a child
and
their needs.
There.
No, it's not. And it's a wonderful opportunity. CASANewHampshire.org is where you can find out how to be a volunteer with them.
Well, we've got links and information on our website as well. But real quickly, Director O'Neill, what's your hope about what your next annual report will say?
Well, I hope it's shorter.
It wasn't too long.
And I can't tell you how much we appreciate how many people read the report, and it's spawned a wonderful conversation. People are aware of children and issues. And so I hope that we'll be able to report that more people got involved, that we're more aware of where children are. There are fewer children in foster care. And to speak to the community services that the last caller mentioned, that we have really clear contracts and expectation with all providers who provide services for children, whether they're in care, whether they're in an institution, or whether they're being driven around the state.
All right. Well, again, that's Director Moira O'Neill. She's the head of the New Hampshire Office of the Child Advocate. Director O'Neill, it was nice to sit down with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you to all the callers who got in touch with us.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.